Case number 13-1182, Dish Network, LLC Petitioner versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Mr. Jane for the petitioner, Mr. Bourne for the respondent.
Mr. Jane.
May it please the court, Samir Jane on behalf of petitioner Dish Network. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In the order below, the FCC concluded that a seller of goods and services such as Dish could not be directly liable for violations of the TCPA committed by third parties, but could be vicariously liable. It further found that vicariously liability should be governed by the common law of agency. Dish does not challenge either of those determinations on appeal. But the FCC did not stop there. It went on to offer incoherent and incorrect guidance about the meaning of common law that went well beyond its expertise. The FCC seeks to avoid review of its pronouncements about common law agency on the grounds that they are non-final and unripe for review, an issue to which I will turn shortly. But before doing so, I just want to highlight some of the respects in which the FCC's order gets agency common law wrong.
Why does that matter if we don't have judicial review? So I think you ought to start with the question of whether
Let me start with finality then.
And unsurprisingly, I really would like to know how you can distinguish this case from American tort reform. We just dealt with these round of issues. Actually, there's another case as well that went out on unpublished. Let me tell you what I understand from this record. You can tell me if I'm wrong. The parties don't disagree that the agency has no authority to opine on the matters that you are concerned about. They don't claim they do, and you assert they do not. They have asserted that they do not mean to do anything that has the force of law, and there's no present dispute before us. That's the American tort reform case, precisely. And we said there's nothing for us to do.
With respect, Your Honor, I don't think the FCC has quite made the same level of concessions that you had in the American tort reform case, because here the FCC has not, for example, disclaimed Chevron deference. It's left that open in its brief. It's claimed specifically...
We can ask them that. Okay.
It's claimed specifically in its brief that it has statutory authority to issue this guidance and that this was part and parcel of its implementation of the Act. And the agency says that its intention here is to remove uncertainty and to provide uniformity, both of which are only possible if it really expects courts to follow this
guidance.
Yeah, but
if they have no authority to do this, which you assert vigorously, and which is a compelling argument, they don't seem to dispute it, so what?
Well, I think if it were clear that the agency, in fact, has no statutory authority to speak with the force of law...
With respect to these matters.
Right, with respect to the common law, that it is not entitled to Chevron deference, or really that its guidance is not entitled to any deference or special weight, and that courts are free to ignore this guidance altogether and simply to take the common law as they find it based on judicial precedent and apply the common law without giving any particular weight to what the FCC has said because the FCC has said it, then we might be in that situation. But the FCC hasn't, at least at this point, up to this point, gone that far. It's left open the Chevron deference.
Well, suppose we were to say they don't have any authority.
I think if you were to say that it doesn't, as I said, if you were to say that they don't have authority, that a court is free to disregard what it is the FCC has said about common law, that it's not entitled to any special weight or deference, then we would go a long way toward the OSHA case. But we're not there yet, at least
but
at this
point. But if they say that, or we say that, we're there.
I think that's – I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Can I scale this down then a bit from where you and Judge Edwards are? Assume that the agency has authority in the sense that it's not acting ultra vires by saying this is what we think agency law is. But all they're saying is that courts follow them if they're persuaded. Courts don't follow them if they're not persuaded. That is Skidmore deference. They have no authority to bind a court, but they have authority to say what the agency thinks the law is. And if they're persuasive, that's fine, and if not, that's fine too. Isn't that also the end of this case?
Your Honor, I think what needs to be clear is that whatever the agency has said in paragraphs 46 and 47 is not entitled to special weight.
What about Skidmore deference? Do you regard that as special or not special?
I think to the extent that Skidmore deference simply means that it's an argument a court is free to consider, much like the argument of any other party, and to apply its understanding of common law and to the extent
it finds it. To the extent it's persuasive. That's the definition of Skidmore deference in Christensen. Yeah. Assume that's the definition.
I think, again, that as long as it was clear that a court is free to ignore what it is that the FCC has said, that it simply can accept it if it finds it persuasive in the same sense as another party argument.
So even if it has authority to state its views, as long as its views have no more weight than to the extent they're persuasive, it's not final with respect to another court, right?
I think that we would certainly argue that to another court that it wasn't that it's not that that it shouldn't get any more weight than it would any other party's argument to the extent it was persuasive. Although I do think that Skidmore deference here isn't quite a fit because Skidmore deference is usually applied where an agency is at least opining about the statute in question. Here the agency
so they might get less than Skidmore deference, but that's something to be argued to a court.
Well, but I think that it's up to this court to construe what it is.
Why is it up to this court? I mean, we're not being asked to give deference to anything that they say. We're not being asked to apply it to anything they say.
No, but the court, under the Hobbs Act, has exclusive jurisdiction to determine the effect of the FCC order here.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that the FCC's order is not due any deference and is not, in fact, construing the statute, but instead is simply opining on the common law over which it really doesn't have any expertise or authority, then I think it is part and parcel of the Hobbs Act review of the order to say that the agency has
gone. Well, the case I think is most directly on point, slightly scaled down from the more recent opinion, is American Telephone and Telegraph Company versus EEOC, in which we said the commission has not inflicted any injury upon AT&T merely by expressing its view of the law, a view that has force only to the extent the agency can persuade a court to the same conclusion. If that's what we regard as what they've done here, then it's not final, correct?
Your Honor, but the order, at least as currently being interpreted by the courts, is going beyond that. So we have courts.
That may be another court's made a mistake about interpreting it.
Well, and I think part of what DISH seeks here is to clarity so that other courts recognize that the FCC order doesn't, in fact, have the force of law.
You think we can bind another court?
I think as a matter of your exclusive jurisdiction of the Hobbs Act, you can opine authoritatively on the extent to which the FCC.
Of course, they only have to listen to us to the extent they think we're persuasive, too, right?
Well, I think because you have exclusive authority under the Hobbs Act to review the FCC order, to the extent you were to say that the FCC order, for example, has no force of law, I think that, in fact, is a binding ruling.
If we say that in the context of saying there's no jurisdiction, that's what we would be saying. Another circuit, over which we have no review authority, would simply say, well, it's very nice what the D.C. Circuit says, but their ultimate conclusion is they have no jurisdiction. And a court that has no jurisdiction can't bind the Second Circuit or the Tenth Circuit or the Seventh Circuit. In fact, we couldn't bind them even if we did have jurisdiction.
Yeah, but if the reason that you don't have jurisdiction is that the FCC order does not have the force of law and those kinds of things, I mean, that would really put DISH into where it couldn't collaterally attack the FCC order in the Second Circuit, for example, because at that point it would have been reviewed under the Hobbs Act by this court and there would be no avenue for collateral attack. So, I mean, you would be in a position where the Second Circuit would say, I disagree with the D.C. Circuit that it was final and therefore it should have been reviewable.
Guess what I'm asking is you're actually risking a worse result by bringing this litigation. If we decide we do have jurisdiction and then decide the merits of the questions you're talking about, then we actually make a merits decision. We make a merits decision is maybe that their view of agency law is as they say, or maybe it's slightly like they say and not quite as much as you say. If we say there's no jurisdiction, then there's nothing to it. It's up to another court. Otherwise, we may be binding another court. I'm not sure whether you want that or not.
Well, but what we want is clarity that for other courts, the district courts around the country, that, in fact, they don't need to and that they shouldn't defer to what the FCC has said here about common law and that what the FCC has said about common law is due no particular weight and that they're free to ignore it. Unfortunately, courts like the May Court, the Savannah Group Court, have taken the opposite view up to this point. They've viewed what the FCC has said about common law as having weight and as due deference.
No, I read those cases and I don't read them the same way. I hear what you're saying, and one of them cites the paragraph, but they look to the FCC only with respect to matters that you do not dispute. They did not look to the sections that you dispute and give deference to the agency. One of them did not, and the other didn't at all.
With respect, Your Honor, in the May case, the court explicitly says it was, quote, applying the FCC's declaratory ruling. And
with
then,
respect to matters that you don't dispute.
No, but in that same paragraph, it goes on to say that there's evidence that the telemarketer was authorized, and therefore that's enough to defeat summary judgment. That's what the FCC seems to say in paragraph 47 of its order. It says that that it sees no reason why a telemarketer who is authorized shouldn't be able to result in vicarious liability for the seller. And that's exactly what the FCC says in paragraph 47. And the May court says it's applying the FCC declaratory order ruling. And in the Savannah group, it says that the seller's liability under the TCPA, quote, turns in part on the factors identified in the declaratory ruling as indicative of apparent authority, meaning the factors identified in 46.
I read that court to say that under common law, this is where they would have decided whether the FCC had said anything.
Well, but the court doesn't say that. It sort of looks to...
I don't know how I got that.
The court looks to the FCC.
That's what they appeared to say.
The FCC looks to the FCC order.
Well, they looked at it, but they didn't say it was due Chevron deference.
But again, Your Honor...
Which is what your worry is. Neither one of those courts are saying they're entitled to Chevron deference.
Well, I think it goes beyond simply Chevron deference, Your Honor. I think to the extent that the agency here is opining on matters over which it really has no expertise and it's getting that wrong, what we are saying is that it should be clear that other courts in private litigation should not in any way give special weight or authority to what the FCC has said because the FCC has said.
How do you write that in light of what the Chief Judge has been, the questions the Chief Judge has been raising?
I think you
is
could
write a declaration to all other federal courts. You better not.
No, I think, Your Honor, that an opinion from this court that said that the FCC order is not final because, with respect to the common law guidance, because that guidance, the FCC has no authority to speak with the force of law as to common law, that it's what it has said is not due deference or any special weight, and that courts are in fact free to ignore it and apply their understanding of common law. That. An opinion that says something.
You've got that in their brief to us. They said there's no, they're not entitled to any more deference than, if it's deference even, than Skidmore might allow, to the extent that what they say is persuasive, the court ought to look at it.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, in their brief, they actually leave quite open the possibility of Chevron deference. They don't disclaim it. Second of all, they're quite explicit in saying that the guidance that was offered here was part and parcel of their statutory authority and that they had ample statutory authority to issue it. They also say that their intent here is to bring uniformity and to remove uncertainty, which only happens if courts actually follow this guidance. And so I don't think this is like the ATRA case, the recent ATRA case, in which the OSHA had made a lot of the significant concessions. The FCC hasn't made those kinds of concessions. And the fact that you see the confusion in the district courts about how to deal with this order, I think, is just further confirmation of that.
Does it make any difference here that the declaratory ruling arose as a result of petitions seeking the agency's views in light of its primary jurisdiction? And so the argument in part is that the declaratory ruling is a final order. And the SEC acknowledges that at least to its consummation of its views. And the only thing is, it says, well, the second prong doesn't have any legal effect. And my question is whether or not the context here changes that analysis any.
I think the context does make a difference because it's arising from a primary jurisdiction referral and because, as the FCC itself says in footnote 137, its intended audience here, at least, is in part courts that are dealing with private litigation.
So in order, I mean, is the argument in part, in order for this court basically to say what you want us to say, we need to determine that we have jurisdiction to determine whether or not paragraphs 46 and 47 were within the authority or have any legal effect beyond their ability to persuade?
Well,
in other words, what I'm trying to get at is absent agency concessions along the lines that we've been discussing, how does this court say anything other than, you know, it's not a final order, or if we went even to the agency's view about rightness?
Well, I think if the agency doesn't make those concessions, that, in fact, its intent and what it has said, both in footnote 137 and its briefs, make clear that, in fact, the order has legal consequences. I mean, it's one thing if the agency concedes the points that we've all been talking – that we've been talking about. But if the agency doesn't make those concessions and its intent and what it is seeking to do is to have courts follow what it has said with respect to common law, then I think it does have legal consequences and meets the test for finality.
Well, we just – I mean, respectfully, counsel, that's just not consistent with the law of the circuit. We have said the mere fact that you can show that there's some courts that have followed the thing that you object to does not prove the point you're trying to make, that this has the force of law.
I think
it's
by
a policy statement or an interpretive statement, more a policy statement, that may be followed by a court doesn't make it anything more than a policy statement.
I think by itself that's right, Your Honor, but here you've got not only that, but you've got the FCC's own statements in the brief and in the order saying that they're trying to bring about uniformity, that they're trying to remove uncertainty. You've got the FCC in footnote 137 making clear that its intended audience here is the courts, and that the guidance it's offered here is pursuant to its authority to interpret and implement the TCPA. So here, whereas in the OSHA case you may have just had that one isolated court decision, here you've got not only those court decisions, but you've got confirming language from the agency as to what its intent was, and you've also got the context, as Judge Rogers points out, that this arose entirely out of referrals from courts, and so clearly the intended audience.
You surely don't mean to go very far with that, do you? Really, because it's in the context of a declaratory order? Anything said therein?
No, I don't.
Of course not. Rogers ended with, but we have these paragraphs which are not meant to be anything more than Skidmore type stuff, which is what? The fact that it's in a declaratory order can't be dispositive.
No, again, I'm not suggesting that that's dispositive. My point is that where the court has said, where the agency has said that its intended audience is the courts, and that its intended goal is to bring about uniformity and to eliminate uncertainty,
the words about uniformity and uncertainty? Where are those? Where are you finding those words?
Page 32 of the FCC brief.
Well, the brief is irrelevant, right? The only issue here is what's in the rule,
right?
What's in the order.
Well, and then in the order itself, it doesn't, in footnote 137, it doesn't use the uncertainty.
No, all it says is there's no good reason we shouldn't provide guidance. Doesn't say that anybody has to follow their guidance.
Right, but it's providing guidance to, among other things, the courts, and then it goes on to cite a case in which it says that this part of this guidance is part and parcel of its delegated power to the, delegated authority to interpret and implement the TCPA. And so it's claiming there, it seems to me, I think, that the guidance here is part of its statutory authority to interpret and implement the TCPA, which I think is a statement that this is part of its authority. It's not just some random observations about common law agencies.
If all those things were true, why would it only say this may be persuasive, this may also be relevant, this may be supported, this may demonstrate? Why does it say that in 46 rather than this does demonstrate, this establishes, courts must follow? Why doesn't it say that?
They use a lot of different words there. They use may, they sometimes say would, they sometimes say should in that paragraph. And they also say that at a minimum that evidence of the kind that they're highlighting should shift the burden of proof to the seller, which
should
is contrary.
Should be sufficient, which maybe should be sufficient or not, depending on what the court says. I guess we can hear this from them. So I have one more deeper question for a moment. Imagine that they had decided that the words on behalf of mean exactly what they say, not whatever common law of agency means, but they describe what it says. Is there anything that would have prevented them from saying that?
I think we would have been here arguing, A, that it was substantively unreasonable because on behalf of, for example, appears only in respect to the provision about the do not call registry. It doesn't appear in the robocalling provision, so there's no comparable language there. I think they would have had authority. It would have been a different argument in the sense that we wouldn't have been here saying.
Right. You'd argue against their interpretation.
Right.
But you don't disagree that they actually have authority to define the meaning of this statute here, including the extent of vicarious liability.
That's why we haven't challenged, for example, the determination that common law agency should be the governing standard.
So they gave you a little bit more than they necessarily had to with respect to their authority. That is, they decided to incorporate common law rather than just establish what the agency law was.
But I don't think that was a matter of grace by the agency, Your Honor, particularly, as I said, with respect to robocalling.
I don't think it's grace. I think it's what they thought was right. But the statute doesn't say apply the federal common law if agency does it.
No, but with respect to robocalling in particular, where there isn't the on behalf of language, mm-hmm. there is no language on which to hang the hat of vicarious liability. And so the only real theory, and certainly the only real theory the FCC offers, is the background presumption
yes.
that there's that common law agency supplies the rule. So I don't think that it was just sort of a matter of choice, particularly with respect to the robocalling provision. I think that was really the only legal avenue by which they could get vicarious liability imported into the statute.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. We'll hear from the FCC.
May it please the Court, my name is Nick Bourne, and I represent the Federal Communications, in this case, Commission. As this discussion was being played out, our position is that the Commission does have authority to speak to the meaning of common law agency as it's incorporated into the TCPA, but that we did not intend to bind in this order. The paragraph 46 guidance
You didn't intend to bind courts. Right?
Correct.
And you didn't intend to get Chevron deference.
That is correct.
And you only intend to get whatever deference your persuasive power persuades the court to give you.
That is correct.
Right. So I don't know if there's anything else to ask here. But either my colleagues have any further questions.
Nope. I just want to add one thing.
You can only get yourself in trouble if you say any more.
All right.
They should teach this in appellate advocacy school. When you're ahead...
Stop.
Sit down.
Thank you very much.
All right. Do you have anything further to say?
Yes, sir.
All right. We'll take the matter under submission. Thank you.